I'd like now to welcome Charlotte Keith. Her one-woman play is called If a Door Opens, A Journey with Frances Perkins, directed by Bruce McIntosh and presented by the Meta Theater in association with Teatro Paraguas. And Charlotte will be doing performances this coming Friday and Saturday, May 17th and 18th at 7:30 in the evening, and then Sunday, May 19th at 2 in the afternoon at Teatro Paraguas here in Santa Fe. Welcome, Charlotte, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm so happy to be able to talk with you.
This is such an interesting person. Like probably most of our listeners, I had never heard of her. Who was this woman, Frances Perkins?
Well, your comment is quite common. When I do my show, people go, why haven't I ever heard of her? Well, the most probably significant thing is that she was the very first woman cabinet member in the history of the United States, appointed by Franklin Roosevelt. And then, of course, she was the architect of the Social Security Act, which people don't really realize. They give Franklin Roosevelt, you know, the main credit for it. But she was the one who actually wanted it, had a committee, they researched it, and she got it through Congress.
How did you come across her life?
Well, it was interesting. At the time, I was living part-time in Lubbock, Texas, and part-time in Taos, New Mexico, and I went to a meeting of the Texas Democratic Women, and a woman gave a book talk about a biography about her. I think that I had heard her name. I think there was some name recognition, but when she began talking about this person, I just became so intrigued and enthusiastic. And a few years earlier, I've always been involved in community theaters wherever I lived, and my husband, Don, he's a great fan of mine, and he said, sometime you should do a one-woman show. And I said, well, I don't know, you know, nobody came to mind. But that very day when I was listening to this talk about her, I thought, I was just overcome. I thought, this is who I want to do a one-woman show about. I mean, it was just like within a few minutes, then I said it out loud to a friend of mine, and I thought, okay, I've got to do this. So I'd never written a play before or anything like this. So it was quite an adventure, and it's been a wonderful adventure. You know, learning, I researched her, for a little less than a year, and then started writing the play. And what I really wanted to do was kind of track her life as, like, how does a person who was born in 1880 become the first woman cabinet member? You know, and so it was interesting to track her life as to how she got into a position where a president, and before that, the governor of New York, called on her expertise to be head of the Labor Department in New York, both Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt. But what gave her, why did they trust her? And so that's sort of why I call it a journey. It's how did she get to that position? And so there are little stories about, significant stories that show what kind of person she was.
Well, and it's interesting, you paint such a nice picture of her. I mean, from the earliest age, she was very strong and self-possessed and had a good head on her shoulders and knew what she wanted. What were some of the first things that she did?
I think as a young woman, maybe even as a child, she didn't really recognize it, but she lived in a factory town. And she could see, she was very sensitive to discrimination and how people, poor people, were treated. But I guess her, you know, as I sort of go through it in the play, she was exposed to factory workers from a university course she was taking at Mount Holyoke College. And then from there, she wanted to become involved with helping the poor. And so I guess her first job, she was hired by the New York Consumers League, and they worked on labor reform. She was very passionate about labor reform.
One of the things that the play does so beautifully, I think, is it really reminds us how bad things were. I mean, not that they're so great now, but it's, I mean, how far we've come in terms of labor practices and laws. I mean, Frances, in your play, tells a story of a woman who's a factory worker whose hand was cut off, and they just bandaged her and sent her home.
Right. They were treated a little better than, you know, slaves, really. I mean, they were paid so poorly. It was when factories were becoming very, you know, abundant, and the factory workers, the people that worked in factories, were immigrants who, you know, had come to America hopefully for a better life and were not treated so well. You know, it's like, oh, well, I guess that phrase, there are a dime a dozen. One can't work, we can find another. There's plenty more behind that person to work. There were no, you know, like you say, benefits, or I think, you know, a lot of maltreatment. And as you say, yes, we have come. I mean, it's kind of hard to realize that how badly people were treated and taken for granted. But she was very acutely aware of it. I have to think she had some innate empathy. She possessed that from a very young child, always kept it. She never did anything, I think, for a selfish reason other than to promote her agenda to help the working class.
She actually witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, that famous, I mean, this is engraved in my memory forever because they used to show us actual films of that disaster when I was in history class as a kid in school.
Yes, she did. She was an eyewitness to it, and it influenced her a great deal as to her passion to, again, she was living in New York, and she even campaigned, which I don't go into all the details of everything that she campaigned for, but one of the things she did was to get fire escapes on buildings, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
She worked hard to just get things like, you know, just safety, fire escapes. You know, people had factories in basements and every place. You know, they're very unsafe for people to work.
One of the outcomes of the Triangle Shirtwaist disaster that's also shocking, because we hear about this disaster, and we hear about how so many people were killed, and it did lead to better safety regulations afterwards. But one thing that I didn't know was that the owner of this factory had total impunity, not only didn't get punished, but received a whole bunch of money for each worker who was killed, and that money didn't go to their families.
Well, you had the factory owners, and then there were the building owners. And so, you're right. The factory owners were acquitted, and the building owner eventually had to pay a little bit of money, but not much.
Yeah. We're talking to Charlotte Keefe about the one-woman play, If a Door Opens, A Journey with Frances Perkins. It's such an interesting play to me because during this play, you learn a lot about the nuts and bolts of politics. I mean, she had an instinctive and very, very clever way of working the system to eventually get what she wanted, which was, of course, not, as you say, selfish, but basically fair labor practices and things like that.
Correct. Yes, she was an astute observer. She had some mentors, but she knew, like you said, she learned how politics works, and it wasn't like she didn't dig her heels in, like, okay, it's my way or the highway. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something, to me, that was very important part of her character and her intellect, and like you said, an instinctive ability to know how to get things done, because her goal was to accomplish labor reform, and so she learned how to work the system, which I think maybe some politicians could learn from.
Well, she was such a good politician, and she was a lone woman, I think, in a man's world, probably during a whole lot of her life, and not only didn't seem to be intimidated by that, but she actually played it to her advantage. And there's a wonderful part in the play where she talks about the way she dresses just as a way of kind of establishing her position.
Exactly. That was another one of her instinctive. She had a master's degree in both sociology and economics. So she used her knowledge about economics to know how to propose, how to put together bills and plans and programs. And then she was a social worker, actually. And I think that also she learned about human behavior. And so she referred to herself as a scientist. So what she used a lot of her, she learned how to observe things and she analyzed things. And so she analyzed human behavior and she figured out, oh, okay, this is why they're doing this and this is what they respond to. She put it all together and again, she knew, okay, this is what I have to do in this situation.
And one of the things which I found kind of amusing and fascinating was that she thought that, and says, I mean, not to him, to his face, but the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who is a great hero to so many people, was utterly illiterate in economics, and she had to educate him, which she did through simple repetition. She would just keep on telling him how things worked until he got it.
Yes, that was one of her strategies, and I use that in the play. She wasn't being negative or anything. It's just fact.
Right.
You know, this is just fact. This is, you know, obviously Roosevelt had many qualities and was an intelligent man. But again, like I said, she had a master's degree in economics from Columbia University. So she knew that she was, so relatively speaking, I don't really know how much Roosevelt knew about economics, but that was her take. And she knew that she could educate him, which she didn't mind.
And this is the woman who actually, ladies and gentlemen, came up with the idea of Social Security, which is, I think, a very important thing about our history to know, was that it was this woman, the first woman cabinet secretary ever, Frances Perkins, who actually came up with the idea. And the play reveals why health insurance wasn't included in that.
Correct.
Which was almost just a mistake.
Yes, it is interesting that, historically speaking, our country has grappled with providing health insurance for a long, long time.
Yeah.
For some reason, we can't quite. We're getting very close. But yes, it's been on the table for years.
Now, what were the sources that you used, Charlotte Keefe, to write this play and to learn about Frances Perkins?
Well, I began reading biographies. I read about five or six biographies about her, and also the Social Security has a great deal of information about her online. Of speeches, some speeches that she's made. I think I actually found a speech that she made that was audio. And then she also has an oral history. Columbia University has an archive of her oral history that is also online. So just a variety of sources. And the play only just highlights the things that she accomplished. I don't cover everything because that would take hours.
Right, it would take days.
You know, days, exactly, days. So what I did was just the things that really touched me, that I thought, man, this is important as to, you know, painting a picture. I probably didn't get it perfect, but, you know, I really tried very hard to be two things, accurate, but, and maybe not everything is just accurate, because sometimes I might have smushed some things together to make a point. But
right.
I wanted to bring this woman to life for us.
Yeah, you tell amazing stories about her, and we won't obviously talk about all the stories because it's really worth going to see. How did you find her character within yourself as an actress? Were you able to hear actually what her voice sounded like? See, was there any film of her? I mean, creating that character was not only the stories, but really becoming her.
Right. Well, of course, you know, reading everything, I had a notion. And yes, luckily, there are in the her oral history, there's a few of the transcripts, not all of them, where I can hear her voice, which is wonderful. And like, and I found one or two audio speeches that she made. I personally could not ever find any clips of her. However, I saw something on television. They had a nice little thing about her on her birthday, and they had had a little audio clip of her. And of course, there are lots of pictures. But one of the things that I learned from reading and kind of listening to her, she grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts, but her grandmother, her father came from Newcastle, Maine. So she identified really with New England culture. She lived her adult life in New York, but the New England culture is what she always sort of referred to. And so she was very reserved, but she had also had a very, I think it seemed like a very dry humor. She had a wit. She's very, and she kept her feelings to herself. So she was a pretty private person, from what I gathered. I mean, from everything I read and things like that, and sort of, as I said, identified. And I think she and Roosevelt sort of identified with each other a little bit in that regard about, okay, things are personal, life is personal, and, you know, I have a private life and I have a public life.
The play is called If a Door Opens, A Journey with Frances Perkins. It's by Charlotte Keefe and performed by Charlotte Keefe, directed by Bruce McIntosh, and presented by Meta Theater in association with Teatro Paraguas. And it is this coming Friday and Saturday, the 17th and 18th of May at 7:30. And then Sunday, May 19th at 2 in the afternoon, Teatro Paraguas is at 3205 Calle Marie here in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 505-424-1601. Thank you so much, Charlotte, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having me. And I hope everyone comes to see the play. Learn about Frances Perkins.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to find out more, you can also go to the website ifadooropens.wordpress.com, and you will find Charlotte's blog at that place. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Linda Milanese. She's executive director of Assistance Dogs of the West, and Jenny Reichert. She is on the youth board of Assistance Dogs. She's a student trainer, a wonderful dog trainer, and we have an animal with us, a wonderful Labrador retriever named
Gilbert,
who's also with us. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And every year you guys come back, different trainers often, and Assistance Dogs of the West is having its graduation, as it does every year in May, this Wednesday, the 15th of May at 6 in the evening at the Greer Garson Theater. Tell us about some of the different kinds of assistance that the assistance dogs do.
We let our dogs choose their careers, and so they have many, many career paths. Some of the dogs that will be graduating this year, some are mobility dogs. There is a dog that works with a child with autism. There is a medical alert dog who works with a person who has diabetes. There is a facility dog that works with a courthouse facility dog, and they work with child advocates and special victims advocates. We also have another dog who works with an occupational therapist in animal-assisted therapy. Another dog works with a different kind of therapist, a play therapist. And so our dogs work in a wide range of careers. The only thing that we don't train for is sight and hearing.
No seeing eye dogs or hearing ear dogs.
No, because they're trained in an entirely different way.
Now, when you talk about a dog choosing its career, I mean, what do you mean? How do you do that?
Each dog shows us what their temperament is like, shows us what their propensity for work might be. And as a person comes to us and fills out an application and begins the interview process, depending on what their disability is or what their needs are, because obviously we do a lot of facility dogs, and those are for able-bodied people. The dogs interview with them, and they start to show us whether they like to work with a wheelchair or a power wheelchair is something that is extraordinarily scary. Whether they have a really calm temperament where they might be able to sit or lay down in a witness box and help a young child, and they might have to lay there for 4 or 5 hours.
Right.
And their temperament is very calm and very resilient.
So you don't use the Jack Russells for that?
You don't use the Jacks for that. Though I bet you the Jacks might be good seizure alert candidates. You know, because they're so smart. They probably are good medical alert dogs because they have a lot of drive. A diabetic dog, you wouldn't want that super, super calm temperament, because if someone was going low, you would want the diabetic alert dog to keep poking at them, to keep accelerating until they actually paid attention.
And so the dogs, I mean, you have to be good trainers and you have to be really good observers of animals in order to really tell what the inclination is for each dog. You also have to choose the right dogs to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
How do you choose them, and where do you get these dogs?
We are very fortunate to have some of America's top breeders who we have worked with over the years. Gilly comes from a line of dogs in Bangor, Maine. They're champion hunting dogs. They have very, very beautiful, docile dispositions. And he is, I think he's about the fourth generation of dogs we've had from that line. We also have this particular wonderful dog that's on our invitation.
Yes, the invitation has what looks like a golden lab on it.
Yes.
Beautiful dog.
He's a beautiful dog, Ranger Rick. And he comes from another line out of Mamaroneck, New York. Both of these breeders they work together and have probably 75 years of genetic understanding and breeding. So that what we call it is a purpose-bred dog. We have a knowledge of their temperament. We have a knowledge of what kind of work ethic they have, a knowledge of where they came from, their genetics, so that we know that physically they're very able and very healthy. We get some of the dogs and we keep the breeding females.
And so you do some breeding.
We actually send them back to the breeders. They breed them. They whelp the litter. They send us back the mama dog, and they donate 2 puppies.
Very interesting. So even, I mean, it's not something that you feel you could do yourselves, because those breeders have a particular way of dealing with the puppies?
We do occasionally breed our own litters. We've bred 3 litters over the course of 18 years. We just bred a litter last year. This dog was the stud dog. And one of our other lines that comes from Colorado, who we also have had 5 or 6 generations of successful placements with those dogs, that was the mama dog. And she was actually the last breeding female of that particular line.
And so there are basically a lot of retrievers.
Yes.
So no shelter mutts.
We do shelter dogs. Absolutely we do. We do shelter dogs. We have wonderful relationships with all the shelters. When a dog comes in that they think might have the right temperament, because remember, our primary goal is to make sure that the dog that we are training wants to do service work. Not every dog in the world wants to be out in public. Not every dog wants to be paired up and be a working dog. And so we like to really make sure that it's the dog's choice, that that's what they'd like to do.
And when a dog doesn't, what does that mean? It wants a life of leisure?
Sometimes. Some of our dogs have become companion animals for families, which is a perfectly fine career. Some have
that's gone kind of a life of leisure.
It's kind of a life of leisure, depending on the family. Some of the dogs have gone to work for the Border Patrol because they have really, really high drive and they'd like to be a drug dog or a bomb dog. So really, if they choose not to be a service dog, there's lots of other places that they could be very, very successful. And all of that is perfectly fine for us. We just call it a career change.
It's amazing how much they're like humans.
Yes. They're, we kind of feel that it's really unexplored territory in terms of interspecies communication. Like,
yeah.
We've just scratched the surface.
I want to be a law enforcement dog versus I want to be a therapist versus...
Totally.
I mean...
And they really... It really is a moment of grace when they show us what they want to do. When they pick their person, we also let them pick their person. When they pick their person, their primary trainer could be in the room, and that dog only has eyes for the person they want to be with for the rest of their life.
Extraordinary. We're talking about assistance dogs of the West. Now, Jenny, you've been training dogs since you were 11 years old. How did you get into this? Did you have a natural calling, just as some of the dogs themselves also do?
Well, you might call it that. I saw the ADW advertisement in a newspaper, and anything with dogs gets my attention. So I just started to start with the student programs. And ADW is unique in the fact that they have these programs. Most other nonprofits that train service dogs only have professional trainers. But in ADW, they have classes of kids with developmental delays, young kids, and after-school classes. So I began with the after-school classes. And in those, it's a really great opportunity for the children to make a bond with the dog and do something worthwhile by giving it to a person that needs them.
And so this whole process of going through, I mean, how young are the dogs when you start working with them?
The program gets them when they're about 3 months old. They'll go into classes when they're 3.5 or 4 months after they've gotten their shots. And the student trainers will work through them up until what we call finishing, which is where the dogs have all their commands polished off and then they go to their person. So depending on how long the student themselves decides to stay in the program, they can work with the dog throughout its entire training period.
And you've done that?
I have. The dog that I worked throughout the entire time, her name was Bia. She was a Great Dane Labrador mix, one of the few mixes we've had in the program. And I worked with her from when she was very young up until she graduated.
And what kind of dog is she now?
She helps a man with muscular dystrophy, and he lives in Albuquerque. She's very great. She helps with opening doors. I think one of her coolest tricks is he has difficulty raising his hand above a certain level, so she'll stick her head under his hand and pick it up so he can reach a doorknob. She'll go get Cokes for him out of the fridge. She'll pick up anything that's dropped. So what she does, a lot of what we picture to be standard service dog work, but it's, of course, very helpful to him.
And it's a big dog, and it's good to have a big dog because that dog can open cabinets, open refrigerators, and all that kind of thing.
Yes, big dogs are very helpful, and it's also easier for them to reach the handicap buttons. But we have a Papillon who helps raise our puppies, and he is a mighty dog. He will pick up brooms for you. He can open doors. He can do pretty much anything a big dog can do, provided he can reach it.
What do you mean that the dog helps raise your puppies?
Well, our puppies need to have a very healthy respect of little dogs, and Riley, the Papillon, does this because he is mighty. He teaches them to sit down and behave themselves. So after puppies meet him, they never bother another little dog in their lives.
It's amazing. Yeah. Now, how did you train the dog to open doors and refrigerators and all the things that you were talking about? I mean, I guess you had to be trained to do that kind of training to some extent.
Yes, in the classes, the trainers explain to the student trainers and demonstrate how to do that. ADW uses what's called the positive reward method to train the dogs. They use little devices, which is what I've got in my hand. They look like a rectangle with metal inside. They make a clicking noise.
Here, go ahead and click it. Ah.
And what that means, now I have to feed Gilbert, who's here. It means food. It means you've done something right, and you're about to get food. So these dogs learn from when they're very small puppies that when they hear that noise, they've done something right, they can advance on that. So if they so much as look at a tug strap, which is what they pull to open the door, then they get a click, then maybe they'd move a little closer, they get another click, they put their mouth on it, they get another, and so on until they learn that. And once the dog is doing it with 80% accuracy, we start putting the word to it. We don't immediately start saying tug. We wait until they're doing the action, so they see a tug strap, they pull it, and then we say tug.
Now, I would think that the dogs, just like human beings, when we do a job well, the dogs also have a kind of satisfaction. Does it seem like that to you?
Definitely. There are certain dogs, the rewards differ greatly. We have the golden retrievers who love being touched. We have the labs who love their food. So they get trained with those things that they like as rewards. And after that, once they have their person, it's really just the thrill of working for that person. And they won't need any treats all day long. So the deeper the bond with the person they're working with, the fewer food they need.
Have you ever had situations where the person who gets the dog is not kind to the dog?
No.
No. So basically, these are very good bonds, good people in the first place who you're working with.
And we have a very rigorous screening process. People need to fill out an application. They go through an assessment with our occupational therapist. Then they may interview for a dog for well over a year. So we are very careful about how we place the dogs, and we also reserve the right to take the dog back should anything happen.
But it doesn't.
But it doesn't. In 19 years, we've only ever had two dogs come back. One came back because it actually wasn't the greatest match, and the other dog came back because the woman went into a retirement home, and she actually wanted the dog to be able to work for someone else because the dog was really young, and so she went and worked for a 12-year-old girl.
Wow.
It was really moving because the woman who originally had the dog, at graduation, she was the person who gave the dog to the young person.
And that, to break that bond and say goodbye to that dog must have been so hard.
It was so hard. But she was, it's just like for us as trainers, everybody asks us, how do you raise a dog and keep a dog and then you give it up? But when they really find their person, and you can really tell when they found their person,
right.
It's such an incredible thing that even though it's bittersweet and you will miss the dog, you feel so happy that they found what they really were looking for.
And then you've got a new generation of dogs.
Yeah, we do. We can always give you another one.
I mean, that's the beautiful thing about dogs. And when you lose dogs, it's so heartbreaking. And there's always another dog who will love you just as much as that one did.
Exactly. In a different way.
So what happens at Assistance Dogs of the West graduation?
Well, the main point of it is to show people the clients that these dogs go to. The student trainers that have been working with the dog longest will bring it out on stage and say a few words about what it was like to work with this dog, what the dog was like, and how they learned from training it. And then they'll pass it on to the person that this dog has been placed with. And then that person will say what the dog helps them with, what a big change it was to get it, and thank the student trainers and the professional trainers for their work.
It's really just a formal ceremony to acknowledge all the work that the students put into these dogs and to give them the opportunity to really take the leash and hand it over to the person. It's quite moving.
Linda Milanese is Executive Director of Assistance Dogs of the West. Jenny Reichert is student trainer and on the youth board. They are going to be at the graduation at the Greer Garson Theater on Wednesday at 6 o'clock, Wednesday the 15th of May. For more information, you can call the Lenzic box office at 988-1234 for tickets. You can also go to assistancedogsofthewest.org. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And thanks to Gilbert.
I'm sure he would thank you as well, except he's asleep.
I'd like now to welcome fiction writer Ramona Ausubel. She's the author of the new book of short stories, A Guide to Being Born. And tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, she will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a book with multiple short stories, but they're divided into sections called Birth, Gestation, Conception, and Love. And there's so much physical kind of visceral sensation in this book. I mean, it's about being in a body, so to speak. Did you conceive of the stories as going together in some way? I mean, as a whole, or are they kind of compilations of different things you've done at different times? How did that go?
I did not conceive of them as a body at first. I just was sort of writing one story to the next. And when I had a pile of stories after a couple of years, I looked back at them and it became very clear that I had certain things on my mind. I kept coming back to this idea of sort of pregnancy and parenthood and the weight and great joys of both of those things. Not being a parent myself yet, I was sort of just looking at that possibility before me. And apparently it was on my mind. So after I sort of realized that and I wanted to press the issue, I kind of wanted to put the collection together around that kind of center of gravity and allow for the idea that we are born over and over in our lives, that there's, you know, the moment that we are actually born into the world, but then we transform so much when we, as we grow up and when we ourselves become parents and then when our own parents get old and then when we ourselves are looking at the end of our lives, there's all these huge transformations that I sort of wanted to think of as births.
So you have, since you wrote these stories, become a mother. Does it make you see the stories in different ways?
In some ways it does. I think in a way it would have been harder for me to write the stories when after I'd had a child, just because I'm so close to it now, and it's harder to see things, I think, when you're right up against them. And in, I could sort of imagine my way in, and I was free to, you know, it was true fiction. I could really imagine situations that were so different from my life. And I think once you're kind of, it's your own true life, you're more, you have allegiances and you want to get it right and you want to be more careful to sort of, everybody involved feels more real to you. So it's a different, the stakes are different. But I think none of them strike me as untrue. Now, having had a child, I think, for example, there's a story in the book called Atria in which a teenager gets pregnant and she can't imagine that she's going to give birth to a human. The pregnancy comes of a not a situation involving love, and she feels like this creature inside of her, how could it be born and be a person? It seems to her that it's going to be, first she sort of imagines it as a ball of light, and then later it's sort of this eagle, and then later it's a three-headed giraffe. And I think then when I was pregnant, I was thinking back at that story and feeling like, oh, that feels very possible. I mean, who knows? I didn't expect that I was going to have a three-headed giraffe. I was pretty sure I was going to have a human baby, but everything else about it was completely unknown. The vastness of what you are entering into is quite profound, and I think that it's natural. I'm sure we all have really huge questions in that moment.
Very much so, and one of the stories that really affected me was the story about parents of a child who was developmentally impaired, and the child was never going to have more than the mind of a baby, but it was getting to have the body of an adolescent and later an adult. And what do you do about that? And that story is, first of all, it's really creepy. And it's also like, it acts on both a completely real level. These are perhaps decisions about what to do about that real parents are making, but it's also on this metaphorical level. Can you keep somebody from growing up?
Right, exactly, yeah. And I think it's just such a huge weight to have to bear, and decisions, very real, specific human decisions that you have to make in a situation that feels so impossibly big and inhuman in a way that is, how could you ever know what to do? And I think we all face things like that at moments in our lives that feel outsized and that we are really incapable of sort of measuring up to, yet we have to face them and we have to proceed with regular, you know, you have to make a phone call and call the doctor and make a decision about what to do in that day, on that regular day on earth.
And these are such historical moments because, I mean, in another era, that same child would have been drowned in the river when it was 6 months old.
Of course. Yes, exactly. Yeah, there are things that we can do now that our brains have made possible, and yet I think our brains are also incapable of really grasping at the same time.
Exactly. We're talking to author Ramona Ausubel. As I was reading through your stories, I kept thinking about surrealist painting, and there was this sense of a kind of visual surrealism. Is that something that you think about when you're writing or that you see after you've written some of your stories?
Definitely, yes. I think I'm really interested in how an exaggeration can let us see a very regular problem or question. So none of the fantastical elements in the book are really outside of the world. I think of them just as magnifications of things that we are thinking about all the time. So I think that situation we were just talking about with the parents of the developmentally disabled daughter, that is as unbelievable to me a situation as a story like there's a story called Chest of Drawers where an expectant father is sort of feeling left out of the physical process of pregnancy, and then he develops these drawers in his chest, actual physical drawers. So I was sort of using that magnification of the feeling he had of kind of emptiness and helplessness, and I gave it a space to exist in the physical world and so that we could sort of get a real look at it, which I think is I find satisfying just as a writer and also as a reader. I love to read stories that do that, and that there's so much around us all the time. Our lives are so full of amazing and strange and hard and sad things. But oftentimes I think they're hard to sort of see clearly. And I think using those surrealist kind of motions let us kind of look at them and examine them in ways that we couldn't otherwise.
This is a book of short stories. You've also written a novel. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, first of all, did you do one first? Did you write the novel first or the short story? And how those two forms are the same and how they're different?
Sure, yeah. I actually wrote them basically at the same time. I wrote the first versions of the stories first, but I continued to come back to them throughout the whole process of writing the novel. And I think partly I was, you know, sort of getting going as a writer, and I thought, oh, people write novels. I want to write a novel. Let's try that. And I had this idea that I'd been kicking around for years about family, these family stories that my grandmother had been telling me about her parents in Eastern Europe and these really amazing and impossibly sad situations. And I really felt like they needed more space than a short story could give them. So I set to work writing the novel, and it was much scarier for me to do that for such a long time than to get to the first draft of a story. I find that the first draft is the hardest part because you just don't know until you've got it all down. There are people who can plan and who have faith that they will be able to follow their plan, but I don't really work that way. I kind of have to discover the magic as I go. So the process of writing the first draft of a novel is a little bit terrifying, where the process of writing a first draft of a story is, you know, a few days, and if it doesn't work, it's fine. You move on and do something else. But beyond that, I think that I love both forms. I think that the space you get with a novel is really wonderful. And I had a teacher, Christine Scott, who used to describe a short story as a closet and a novel as the whole house. So you get kind of like, once you've got that frame up, you've got your walls, you have all this room to move around, and you get to look at the same questions and the same situations from different points of view or across time in ways that are really exciting and interesting. So I love that about that form. But then I also love about short stories that it's so compact, and you're just in it, and you have this kind of leap of faith that I think you can't take in a novel the same way that I can, you know, sort of a conceit like a man developing drawers in his chest is possible in a short story and much, much harder in a novel, because to keep your reader believing you for 350 pages is much different than for 15 pages. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in that way it can be more like a painting. I mean, it's not that there isn't narrative and there has to be a beginning, middle, and end, but in a way it can be more like just a moment, a pretty short moment in time.
Exactly, yeah. And you get to kind of zoom in on that moment and really examine it and get to know it. And I think I love that. I love writing that way.
You said something before about how when you're working too closely from real life, you get all caught up in getting it right, and that can actually be a hindrance to the process of writing fiction. I think there's another kind of getting it right, which is getting the fictional reality right. And those two things are strangely quite different.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think the fictional reality, once you have some understanding of it as the writer, you have just as much work to do to fill it out and make it feel true and make and follow the rules that you yourself have set for it. So there's a story in the collection called Tributaries where people, it's a world in which when you fall in love, you grow a new arm. So that was the rule that I set out at the beginning of the story. And so then within that rule, my job is to kind of figure out all the ways, all the different mutations of that, how it would manifest itself if a person had always been in love with the same person her whole life, how would it manifest if somebody had sort of fallen in and out of love with various sort of characters that came. There's a character in the story who is, she is covered in hands. She has no full-grown love arms, but she's got all these hands, and they appeared sometimes with real people in her life and sometimes when she was reading about Abraham Lincoln. So I was thinking about the way that love works in the real world and the many trillions and billions of different versions of it and trying to give some of those some physical attributes. So that was a place where I was really working exactly what you're saying, trying to get it right in the fictional world using the parameters that I had set out for myself.
Ramona Ossibel's new collection of short stories is called A Guide to Being Born, and she will be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday, at 6 o'clock in the evening. Now, you live in California, but you are from Santa Fe. You're from New Mexico.
Indeed, yeah. I grew up in Santa Fe. I lived there until I went off to college.
Well, it'll be great to have you back home, and congratulations on this terrific collection of stories.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I can't wait to come back.
Excellent. We'll see you there.
Okay, thank you.